Let me start off with just a couple of verses that may well come on the screen behind me. And they're from Hebrews chapter 10, verses 32 and 33. I'll refer to them later on this evening as well. Why would I choose these verses on Pentecost Sunday? I chose them because, for me, they encapsulate something of what happens in the persecuted world, but also relates to the first century. We know this is Pentecost Sunday. We know that what happened at Pentecost and shortly after it was that the Christians were scattered. It says all but the apostles were scattered throughout the then known world, and the gospel just exploded. And so in hindsight, we can look back, obviously, and see the hand of God in that, how the gospel moved around the world, and actually, well, that's part of the reason why we're here, is because that happened. Disaster at the time for the folks being persecuted, but something happened. This story from Hebrews chapter 10, Hebrews is just an amazing book altogether. And you need to wait for Ken going back before you find out who actually wrote the book of Hebrews, because I'm not going to tell you tonight, even if he asks me, until the cows come home. But whoever wrote the book of Hebrews was undoubtedly somebody who themselves had been persecuted, because they knew the story of persecution personally, firsthand. And they were writing in, as all the New Testament writers, they were writing in to a persecuted church situation. So as you read your New Testament, here's just a wee thought for tonight, maybe the best thought, who knows, but it might just be for you. As you read your New Testament, kind of from now on, would you read it with the perspective that this was written to the persecuted church? Because actually, even words that we're going to read just now, if you haven't already read them when I'm talking, you'll get a flavour of the fact that these words were written to the persecuted church, written by a persecuted Christian themselves. And so, whoever it was that wrote it said these words: remember those earlier days after you had received the light, in other words, after you had become a Christian, when you endured in a great conflict full of suffering. Sometimes you were publicly exposed to insult and persecution. At other times you stood side by side with those who were so treated. For me, it's a cameo picture of the persecuted church in the first century. But actually it's a cameo picture, I believe, of the church today. And I'll come back to that once I've shown you a few slides and we've talked through one or two statistics, I guess, and talked about some people as well. The next slide, please. If you've had anything to do with Open Doors, you will know that at the beginning of each year we produce what we call the World Watch Guide and the World Watch Map. And if you're interested in getting that, along with any other publications, then I've got some wee cards here tonight. It's all I've brought with me. I haven't brought a bookstall or anything else like that. Little card, fill it out, send it off, free post, or give it to me tonight if you like, and you'll begin to get the magazine and the prayer diary once a month, and any information that you would require. So please feel free to take one of those tonight. But on that map, if you've got incredibly good eyesight, if you haven't, then I'll tell you what's on it. It's a map of most of the world, but it's actually got the countries in the world where it's most difficult to be a Christian. And so from 1 to 50, the country's number 1 being the hardest place on the face of the earth to be a Christian. Actually, it's forbidden in that country to be a Christian. Right through to 50, where it's difficult, awkward. You would run risks of somebody stopping you if you talked about Jesus in those countries. Just to keep you awake for another 2 minutes, anybody get any idea where the number 1 country is in the world? Well, the top, North Korea. Well done, sir. You're far too intelligent for me to ask the question that I've asked in the past and been found out to be a fool, but even asking the question, where is North Korea? I won't even ask it, because most people wouldn't answer by saying it's just above South Korea, which is true. That's exactly where it is. But it's number 1. It's as far over to the right as you can get on that map. And in that country, it's already hinted, it's not only the hardest place to be a Christian, it's forbidden to be a Christian in that country. But let me tell you the good news, because there is good news in North Korea. There are between 50 and 70,000 Christians today in labour camp. You might think, that's not very good news. Well, it's good news considering the fact that in North Korea, the country where it's forbidden to be a Christian, there are estimated between 200 and 300,000 Christians. I think that's amazing. In a country where the government, the hierarchy of that nation have said no to Christianity, it's forbidden. If anybody's caught reading a Bible, anybody caught praying, anybody caught meeting together, as a Christian group, then you'll be immediately put in prison and probably for life. In that nation, there are between 200,000 and 300,000 Christians. That's remarkable. God's spirit is moving when other people say, no, it can't happen. It reminds us of, you know, Jesus saying, I will build my church, and the very gates of hell will not prevail against it. So things are happening in that country, which gives us enormous hope. I can still remember when I went to VTI 3 decades ago to do my studies. And I remember that in those days, it wasn't North Korea, it was China. China was the nation where it was just, you know, you couldn't get in. And if anybody tried to talk about Jesus and give out Bibles in those days, that was bad news for them altogether. Now, 3 decades on, you'll know the story as well as I. It's the country where the largest number of Bibles are being printed for worldwide distribution is China. So in 3 decades, things have changed dramatically. And so North Korea is up there just now, but by God's grace, and I suspect by our prayers, the nation of North Korea will be open to the good news of Jesus. I'll tell you a story about that in a moment or two. Thank you. To the next slide, Tom, please. Here's a man that some of you may know of or know his story. His name is Andrew, affectionately known as Brother Andrew. And in 1955, he made it his business to be obedient to God and go where God asked him to go, which at that time in life was, first of all, to London, because he was living in Holland, to come to London, and to come to Glasgow to study at the Wick College. And then as a result of that, went out to Eastern Europe, which was a communist nations at that stage in time, where the border controls were very strong and strict, and you couldn't really get in. And certainly people, the church that was there in Eastern Europe at that time was kind of dying and needed to be refreshed and revived and renewed. I'm just kind of thinking, even as I'm saying it, about the nation of Scotland, but that's what it was like in Eastern Europe, where it was just bad news as far as Christianity and the church was concerned. It was going downhill quite fast. And Brother Andrew, or Andrew as he was known in those days, really sensed God speaking to him and saying, I want you to go. And so he did some, you know, amazing adventures for a young man altogether. He went into a country. The first thing he did, and if you've ever read God's Smuggler, that book, then you would read these stories in it. In fact, you can get a copy of that free as well by filling in the card. Another wee story there, but it's up to you if you want it or not. And he went into Eastern Europe in a Volkswagen Beetle, full at the front, of course, because the boot is at the front. And so he filled up the boot with Bibles and Christian literature, filled up the seats, stuffed Bibles, stuff in and down the seats. And as he drove up to the border controls, he said to the Lord, Lord, you have made blind eyes to see. Would you now make seeing eyes blind? And that's exactly what happened. He drove up, the guards would get in, they would open the boot, they would open the car, they would search his car, and never found any books or Bibles at all. Was able to get in time and time and time again. He was a real adventurer. He was 88 last week. I went last year out to meet him, and he's as sharp as a tack, mentally and spiritually. And I even got a sense last year when I went to see him that he's got a twinkle in his eye, if you know what I mean. He's kind of one of these guys that's just willing to try things just for the sake of doing it. And so in those early days, he would drive up to the borders and he would say, okay, Lord, I'm going to really test you now. I'm going to put some Bibles in the front seat of the car. Just leave them there and see what happens. Not hidden, not out of the way, just there. And the same thing would happen. The border guards would just let him through without even seeing the Bibles that were visible. So he was a real adventurer, and he just wanted to see the churches revived and renewed in Eastern Europe, particularly where it was communists were ruling. And just through his contacts, many, many things happened. Churches were opened up and all that kind of stuff. And then the organisation called Open Doors that he founded just began to grow and grow. And so instead of just one man doing it, nowadays we would be have people staff in 60 different countries around the world. And I think last year there was something like 3 million Bibles given out throughout the world through the generosity of folks like yourselves. So things have moved on rapidly, that's for sure. But interestingly enough, so has the persecution of Christians. It's moved on massively as well. The current figure would be that approximately, it's not far away from this figure, approximately 100,000 Christians will be killed every year for their faith in Jesus. 100,000 people just wiped out the face of the earth because they dare to name the name of Jesus. To do what we did tonight, by singing about Jesus, by praying to Jesus, by talking about Jesus, that's enough. And they're killed for that very reason and others. So, what started 60 years ago is still going on today. Thank you. For our next slide. I won't go through that. You can read it for yourself. There are emerging trends. All I would really say is just keep your eye on the nation of Africa over these next few years. Some, you know, dramatic things are happening in terms of persecution, but dramatic things are happening as well in terms of God's Spirit moving in that nation also. The rise of extreme Islam is happening. We know that. We can read it in our papers. We can see it in our television screens. You know, the extreme end of Islam is on the move. There's no doubt of that at all. And we need to be praying against that for sure, that God's Spirit will move in all sorts of different ways. Thank you, Tom. Next slide, please. This is a picture of a refugee camp. It could have been anywhere. It happens to be in Lebanon. And in Lebanon, where I had the privilege of going in December, they would have received something like, I think the figure, most recent figure this week that I read was 1.7 million Syrian refugees coming into Lebanon, which means a quarter of Lebanon's population are now Syrian refugees. And these folks will have left Syria, left behind good jobs, jobs that you and I would have or have had throughout their lives. They will have left, many of them left families, certainly left good houses, left behind cupboards full of food, left behind the fact that children, where they were before, were able to go out and play in the streets. All of that has gone altogether. They're now living in refugee camps. Some of them look exactly like that in December. That was exactly what it looked like. Muddy fields, canvas tents. You know, when we talk about family living in that, we're talking about an extended family. You know, grandparents, aunts and uncles, all living under that one canvas. Horrible, horrible conditions for anybody, never mind those who have had things before. You know, the professional, qualified people and all the status that would have gone with that, where they came from, now living like this with nothing. Let me tell you a story, because I wanted to put this one up, we could have put up many refugee camps and told many stories, but let me just tell you one that I encountered myself. We went to the north of Lebanon, and we went up to a church and a pastor, and it was about 15 kilometres from the border, so we were pretty close to where this refugee camp is. And we got chatting to him, obviously, and asked his story, and he was able to tell us that the small church that he pastored used to meet in a first floor flat, and just a handful of people, a handful of worshippers there. And then these refugees all started to arrive, just across. They could see it over the hills, as we did in December, and you can actually see the refugee camps. And so what he decided, what they as a small church decided to do, was that they would go against the culture of what was happening in Lebanon. You see, the Lebanese didn't like, many of them don't like, the Syrians. There's just a conflict that has been going on. And so to have Syrians coming into their land, potentially taking their food, potentially taking their jobs, they didn't fancy that at all. So many of the Lebanese do not want the Syrians in their country, but they recognise that they're being hounded out of their own country and they've got to go somewhere, so content that they're living like this. What was he to do as a pastor of a church? Was he to take on the culture of the day, or was he to accept what Scripture says, where Jesus would say, for example, love your neighbour as yourself? And so he decided that he would talk to his church about it and decide, a small group, what we're going to do. And they decided that they would go and visit these people in the refugee camps and to say, well, just a small group of us, but, you know, what can we do for you? And they discover, as we would discover, they needed blankets, they needed mattresses, they needed clothes, they needed food, whatever. And so as a small group, they said, well, we'll do whatever we can. And so they did. They set about the business of trying to find out, making contact with lots of authorities and organisations and saying, you know, can you help us? I'll fast forward it for the sake of time, but I'll fast forward it 9 months. So this all started about February last year, when the refugees started to come in their hundreds and thousands, and now 1.7 million. And so 9 months after this all started, we were sitting in a little lounge talking to him in the church. The church had now moved from across the road in the first floor flat into a building that had been given to them at a much reduced rent, and so they had moved in there. And we said, so what's the church like now? And he said, you know, with tears in his eyes, he said, we have moved on significantly since the early days of the refugees coming. We have a food bank
And they took us to the food bank, and the food bank, I would guess, would be twice the size of this room, packed with food parcels and a queue of people coming to get their food. The church runs that. He said, we have a school in the church building. We have 300 children that come every day for schooling, 150 in the morning, 150 in the afternoon, and these are Syrian refugee children that are coming, all taught by Christian teachers. And these are Muslim children, and their parents are delighted that they're coming to get educated and to be educated by Christian teachers. This is a small church that decided to do something rather than doing nothing. A church that decided to go against the culture of the day and do something rather than nothing. He took us through the back of the building and up some stairs, and honestly, the four of us who were there, our eyes just popped out our heads, because as he took us up these concrete stairs, we saw what is being built just now, which I would only describe as like an amphitheatre. It's huge. And we're saying, my goodness, what's this for? He said, this is for the hundreds of people who are coming, who have become followers of Jesus in the last few months. Hundreds. Not one or two, not just a family or two, hundreds. Mainly women, but men as well, who from a Muslim background have decided to follow Jesus, who've decided to come. Why did it happen? It happened because a wee church, somewhere in the backwaters, almost as it were, decided we need to do something. We need to love our neighbour as ourselves. And God has blessed that people in that church in the most amazing ways. That's kind of why I wanted to show you that slide tonight. God is on the move. I'll probably say this more than once tonight. Forgive me if I just repeat myself, but I think it's really important that in the midst of chaos and atrocities and horrendous things that are happening to Christians, and it's true, it does happen, God is on the move. God is doing things, and it can only be by His Spirit. The same Spirit that fell at Pentecost is the same Spirit today who is moving in different parts of the world. I think we need to take cognizance of that. Here's a couple of quotes. Thank you, Tom. A couple of quotes from church leaders that we've come across. Thank you. Is it coming up? Next slide. Please. Okay. For some reason, it's... Oh, is that it? Good. There we go. Here's the two quotes. Let you read them for yourself. Those that are listening, they won't say this. I have a huge hope, one pastor says. There's an amazing work happening in my country. The Spirit is moving. Thank you. Why do they say thank you? They're saying thank you for praying. Thank you for not forgetting about us. And this is the result. Things are happening. One pastor has told us, we're in a big harvest. God is waking up a sleeping church. Exactly what happened 60 years ago when Brother Andrew said, there's a church out there, but it's sleeping, it's dying. We need to do something about it rather than doing nothing about it. The same thing is happening today. God is awakening up a sleeping church in the Middle East today. Thank you, Tom. Let me just introduce you to a couple of people now. Three people, in fact. Or four people, if you count these two folks in front of you. This is a couple from Central Europe, Central Asia. Long story behind their circumstances, it was awful in the extreme. He was a heroin addict. She was an alcoholic. A married couple, recipe for disaster, as you can imagine, even by that sentence that I've told you. So she decided that she would take her three children and leave the house, and leave him in the house. I mean, that was a disaster, leaving a heroin addict in a house. Obviously, everything was sold to pay for the addiction, but she left the house. She found it intolerable and took the children with her and went to live in a railway station in the town that they lived, and her clear intention was that one day she would get up before the children were awakened in the morning and she would just fall into the train, the first train that came along. She couldn't do it, and the reason why she couldn't do it was because there was a lady who arrived and sat on the railway station bench one morning, the very morning this lady was going to commit suicide. This other lady came and sat on the bench. And this other lady, in a country where it's not forbidden to talk about Jesus, but pastors are not allowed to preach the gospel. That's the kind of country it is. And so this lady came and spoke to this lady on our screen here and talked to her about Jesus and told her that there was life in Jesus and there was hope. And she realised at that moment in time that something had happened, an angel or somebody had brought this lady along, and so she didn't commit suicide. And somewhere down the line, she became a Christian, she gave her heart to Jesus. It was after her husband had become a Christian. He went one day to a church. He'd been encouraged by a pastor who was just bumping into him in the street as he was on his heroin addiction. For about a year, this pastor would bump into him, meet him, talk to him about Jesus, give him scriptures. I hope this is an encouragement to some of us in our workplace or in our street or whatever. That's what that pastor did. And one day, a friend here on the screen, a heroin addict, found himself in a toilet. That's an exaggeration, it's a hole in the ground, but if you get two planks of wood, then it's a posh toilet. That's the kind of place he was in. And he reached out to get the paper and discovered that the paper was a torn up Bible. And as he looked at it, he thought, that's what that pastor was talking to me about. And so, obviously I'm speeding up the story, but he then contacted the pastor and said, I found some of this Bible you've been talking to me about, can you get me a Bible? And so the pastor did. He read some of it, didn't like it, thought it was really harsh, thought this God, who was the I Am, was just, you know, at will striking people off, and just didn't like that at all. Went to a church, met a pastor there, and talked to the pastor at the end of the service one Sunday morning. The first Sunday he went, said to the pastor, I've got lots of questions. The pastor said, let's go down to the basement in the church and we'll talk about it. Suspicious mind says, no, I know what you're going to do, you're going to kill me down there. You have to say, well, pastors don't really do that kind of thing, so let's go down and let's talk. And they went down to the basement through lots of questions and answers being given. He gave his life to Jesus and immediately came off the heroin addiction. Immediately. Never touched heroin again. It was remarkable. It was utterly of the Spirit of God. No question about it at all. What's the stories behind this? Like, now the pastor of two churches, and they're now back together again, and they've got a little child of their own now, which is just amazing altogether. And they are representatives of a Christian organisation, a major Christian organisation in Central Asia. Just remarkable story altogether. The power of God to move in situations altogether. And in the nation where they are, I've told you a little bit about the ethos of that nation. They're just doing an amazing job altogether, but they're being persecuted for it. You know, they've got neighbours who are just stoning the house, there are people trying to kill them at every turn type of thing, because they're being bold for Jesus. They're not giving up on Jesus at all. One quick story, next slide, Tom, if we can get it up. Thank you. This is another chap who's a pastor of a church as well now, and it's his own family that have turned against him. And one of his sisters, who has become a fanatical Muslim as a result of her brother becoming a Christian, tried everything to get him to renounce his faith. And he said, oh, no, I know what I found and I'm sticking with it. I don't know if you can see there, that bookshelf up there. I don't know if you've ever been to Kenneth Ross's library to see what it's like. I can imagine it's a bit more than that that's there. But that's all this guy has as a pastor of the church. That's all these books that he owns. And amazing situation altogether. But his family, particularly his sister, trying to get him to renounce his faith, she even contacted the local police and said, listen, arrest him, take him in and give him a fright, and maybe then he'll renounce his faith. And so they arrested him, and he was smiling when he was telling us this story. And I said, so what's the story? You know, something behind this. Why are you smiling and laughing? He said, it was only 3 days I was in for. And I said, really? I said, what, you know, why 3 days? He said, well, I think it was the fact that in 3 days, 9 inmates became Christians. And so it was easier for them to be out rather than to be in, type of thing. He's an amazing guy. He literally is one of these kind of guys. He's got a story of pretty bad news as he was growing up in the town. And so now he goes out into the streets and he literally gets a box and he stands on top of it and he starts to tell his story. Starts to tell what God has done in his life. And I said, how many people would come to that? He said, you know, by the time I'm finished, maybe a couple hundred. Isn't that incredible? In a nation where you're not allowed to preach the gospel, this boy is just saying, I don't care. I'm going to go for it and see what happens. And many folks are coming to faith. But he's under the cosh. He's under a death threat. We could tell many stories about him. Thank you, Tom. I think it was when I was praying with her that day, along with one of my friends, that this verse just flooded me. Because it encapsulated what his life and many other Christians' lives are like in the persecuted world. when Paul said, for me to live is Christ and to die is gain. It was true. It is true. Because I said to the man in the previous slide, I said, you know, you talk about dying, how do you feel about that? He said, you know, Colin, how I feel about it is that whenever I die, it could be any time now because of the death threats. Whenever I die, he said, this is his words, I know that when I open my eyes, I'm going to see Jesus. For me to live is Christ, to die is gain. That means something to the person who did what. And it has to mean something to me. You know, am I living for Jesus when some folks are willing to die for him? I guess would be another way of putting it. But these folks are living for Jesus, and they love Jesus. They long for their family, their friends, their neighbours to become Christians in spite of the persecution. They long for that to happen. But for them, they've got this perspective as well, that to die is gain. They're going to see Jesus. They're going to be with him forevermore. Thank you, Tom. A couple more slides, and then we'll stop for a song. This is a pastor of a church. I won't mention his name, obviously, but pastor of a church. And this is also in a nation where not only are you not allowed to preach the gospel, which is difficult for a pastor not to preach the gospel, especially a friend here who is just an out-and-out evangelist and, you know, just on fire for Jesus. But it's also a nation where you're not allowed to talk to under 18-year-olds about Jesus. And that's just an embargo altogether. Quick story about that. Every year, his church is involved in running youth camps. Keep in mind, the under 18-year-olds not allowed to talk about Jesus. There are youth camps. 80% of the young people that come, there are 900 come over the summer, 150 every week for 6 weeks. 900 young people under 18-year-old hearing about the gospel, hearing about Jesus in a nation where you're not allowed to talk to under 18-year-olds about Jesus. 80% of them are from Muslim backgrounds, and an incredibly high percentage of those go home giving their life to Jesus. And so you ask the question, the obvious question, so what's it like when you go back to their parents, their Muslim parents? Parents are delighted because they've seen a transformation in their children, and they're delighted about it. And so they're hearing the songs, they're getting the wee plays enacted as we do at any youth camp, all that kind of stuff happens there as well. And many of these parents are becoming Christians as well because of remarkable stuff that goes on. This boy in front of me is a pastor of the church. I said to him, I met him twice now for a week at a time. And the end of the first week I was here with him, I said, okay, what's your vision? He said, my vision is to keep on doing what I'm doing, which is to train up young pastors so that they'll go out and plant churches. And at that stage, there were over 20 churches that had been planted in that country, just by that method. And so people would go, they would get trained up by him, discipled by him, and go and start a church, normally in their own house. And people would come, and the church would begin to grow. And we're talking about handfuls of people, but remarkable things happen in those situations. He said, but I've got another vision, and it's beginning to happen just now. He said, I'm training up young people. Can you hear this? I'm training up young people to be pastors, to be evangelists, so that when the walls of North Korea come down, we're ready to go in. Isn't that amazing faith altogether? This is in a nation right now where you're not allowed to preach the gospel, you're not allowed to talk to young people under 18 about Jesus. He's training up people so that when these walls come down, and he believes they're going to come down soon, when these walls come down, we're ready, he said, we're ready to go in and to share the good news of Jesus with people. I think we've got lots to learn from our persecuted, suffering Christians around the world. Thank you, Tom. The last verse of Hebrews 10 says this: but we don't belong to those who shrink back and are destroyed, but to those who have faith and are saved. Our persecuted family around the world, those who are being hounded out of their houses, those who are losing all their dignity because they're Christians, those who are having their churches burned down, those who are being taken away, or their husbands, or their wives, or their children are being taken from them because they're Christians, are absolutely in the category here of those who are not shrinking back. We do not hear of Christians renouncing their faith because of too much pressure. We do hear of people saying, how much more can we take? How much more can we suffer? Absolutely. We do hear of those who have decided, we can't stay here any longer. We need to move. for the sake of our family, for the sake of, you know, the Christian witness, or we need to move, and we'll support those absolutely that helped, because which one of us wouldn't do that under extreme pressure of losing everything, losing their life even, if they don't renounce their faith. So many of them take the option to leave our country and to move. And so there'll be millions of displaced Christians around the Middle East right now, because they've said, we need to move, we cannot stay here any longer. And none of us would criticise them for doing that. But we don't hear of them saying, you know what, we're shrinking back from this Christianity. We're just going to take the foot off the gas pedal for a while because it's too hot for us to handle. They don't. They don't do that because they have faith, they know who they belong to, and they know that one day they're going to meet Jesus, maybe sooner than you and I, for all we know. But they're going to meet Jesus, and they're not concerned about standing up for Jesus. Quick story. In the Middle East today, a pastor told me this just a few months ago. We had a personal conversation, and he's been there for 12 years in one of the hotspot countries in the Middle East. And he said, you know, people in the UK and around the world as Christians very often wear crosses around their neck, and you know, for many of them it would be, that's their way of letting people know that they've got a faith of some kind and potentially Christians. And he said in the Middle East that's exactly the same. You would find a number of people wearing crosses around their neck. He said, but crosses are easy to hide. If it's a piece of jewellery, you can hide it down a shirt or down a jumper or down a blouse or something. You can just hide it away if you felt the heat was getting too strong for them in terms of pressure. So he said, in order for that not to happen, many of them now would have kind of balconies, you know, outside their windows, albeit pretty messed up buildings for many of them, and they would hang sheets over these balconies that would have either a sign that they're a Christian, like the A for Nazarene would be on that, and they'd be identified as Christians, or other Christian verses, biblical verses on that, so people would know they're Christian. But he said, even at that, people are, you know, sometimes just prepared to pull those in, just in case somebody comes chapping at the door. He said, more recently, what's happened is that in order not to shrink back, in order to be known as Jesus followers, that nobody can deny or nobody can avoid, what many of them are doing now is they're actually getting tattoos printed on the back of their hands as a symbol that they are followers of Jesus. I'm not going down the route of tattoos, whether they're biblical or not. That's not the point of this at all. It's more of a symbolic thing. That can't be rubbed off when you get a tattoo printed on your hand. You can pull a sheet up into a house. You can hide a cross out of the way. You can't hide a printed tattoo that signifies the Christians. These folks are not shrinking back. These folks are holding on to the truth of the fact that they belong to Jesus. And for them to live as Christ and to die, well, that's gain as well. Let me stop there. I've got one more slide, but I'll show it just towards the end, if that's okay. And